You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful 3rd of January. Today the 3rd? No, it's the 2nd. It's the 2nd of January. That's right. Tomorrow is the 3rd. Tomorrow is the day that the new Congress begins. So the second day of the new year of 2013. Some remarkable stuff. And by the way, special greetings to our newest affiliates, to our listeners who are listening on KBCS 91.3 FM in Seattle. Great to have you with us. And, applause all around. Thank you, Shana. Okay, 161 Republicans, 16 Democrats said, nah, we don't want to do this, raise taxes on rich people or cut taxes on working class people, however you want to frame this thing. But 172 Democrats in the House voted yes, and 85 Republicans joined them, and it passed. So what is it? There's like this huge debate going on about this whole fiscal cliff thing and who won and who lost and all of that. And as is usually the case, among the biggest winners are the big banksters. They won several billion dollars. I'll explain that to you in a minute. And, working people made out better than they would have if Mitt Romney was president, much better than they would have if the Republicans controlled the Senate. But, it's kind of taxes on people making under $110,000 a year are going to go up about 2% this year compared to last year because the payroll tax cut is not extended, the Social Security tax cut, which in my mind is a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because the Social Security tax cut was cutting into Social Security. It's a bad thing because it's, up to $2,000 a year, more or less, for people making under $110,000, $113,000 a year, which is pretty much all the working people in America, that they're going to have to pay in taxes and thus not spend in the economy, thus not stimulating the economy. So, I want to get into this. I also want to get into Django Unchained. I'm gonna hold off on my full rant on Django Unchained until after the break, until about 20 minutes after the hour. But I've been kind of holding back on this. I mentioned it a couple of times last week, in large part because, and I mentioned it because Louise and I saw the movie on Christmas Day with our kids in Portland, and we were Portland's a very white town. Oregon is a very white state. We were in a theater that was an all-white audience, and it was interesting. And at first I thought that movie was really just about race and slavery and, kind of a hero's journey, a young man goes off to save his woman kind of thing, his wife. But I've realized there's a whole lot more to it. I'll get into that after the break. But the reason why I wanted to wait a week on this was I wanted to give many of you an opportunity to see the movie. And I'm particularly curious. I saw it as a white guy in an audience full of white guys. And then over the weekend, Louise and I went. We were back here in Washington, D.C., and we went over to the local theater to see The Hobbit, at which we walked out of after about 40 minutes. It was just so dreadfully boring. And, my goal here is not to slam The Hobbit, but as we were walking out of The Hobbit, Django was, the theater just opened or just closed. The movie just ended, and the audience was almost entirely African-American. And I walked into the men's room with a bunch of guys who had just seen Django. And, you can tell after people have seen a movie, after people have seen an action adventure movie, they're all kind of hyped up or a love film or what. These folks were really, really somber. And the white audience that I saw after they saw Django Unchained, they were walking out like they'd just seen a good action movie that had really made them feel good. I thought it was a brilliant movie. So I'm particularly curious to hear And then I was speaking with a friend of mine over the weekend who said that in some of the mixed audiences, the, you know, biracial mixed audiences with both whites and blacks watching the movie together, that sometimes the response of each to the other or each other to different parts of the movie was causing people to scratch their heads. So, you know, I'm curious to open a conversation about that. If you've seen the movie, and particularly if you're African American and you've seen the movie, I would love to hear your take on it. Because as I said, I will tell you 20 after and we'll be taking calls at the bottom of the hour. If you're on hold, you don't mind hanging on, that's great. And, or, you know, that at least puts you in the queue because we have 12 lines here and they fill up fast. And in fact, they're about half full now. So in any case, I want to get into that because at the end of the day, the conclusion that I've come to is that this was not just a movie about race and it was not just a movie about slavery and it was not just a movie about a hero's journey. That really what it was Quentin Tarantino and Jamie Foxx and Leo DiCaprio telling the South, and I'm talking about the modern South as well as the old South, to put their head where the sun don't shine, as the phrase goes, or some you know equivalent thereof. But as I said, I'll get into that in a couple of minutes. I just want to finish up this thing on the fiscal cliff. Because there's a war going on the right and on the right-wing blogs, and there's a war going on the left and on the left-wing blogs about who won and who lost. I think that from the point of view of the average, moderately informed American voter, which is the vast majority, the 95% of, or maybe 85% of American voters who don't carefully pay attention to politics, the president just kicked ass. The president just won. Big victory for the White House and for the Democratic Party. Because the Republicans, they had the Plan B, and Plan B failed, and Boehner thought he had the votes, and then he didn't have the votes. And then on top of that, Eric Cantor was standing there. I've been making this joke for 2 years now. You've been hearing it over and over and over again about how, you know, and it's a those of you who read, you know, Caesar and Brutus, you know, Brutus standing behind Caesar on the steps as they're walking out of the Senate and sticks the old knife in his back and Caesar turns to Brutus and says, "Et tu, Brute? You too, Brutus?" And then dies. And I've been saying Eric Cantor's, you know, every time you see the two of them together, you know, you never see Eric Cantor's right hand in the photo. Why? Because he's got a shiv in it that's poking on Boehner's kidney. And Cantor and, you know, voted against this bill, as did Kevin McCarthy, who's the whip. So the number two and the number three guy in the Republican Party in the House of Representatives voted against this. Boehner voted for it. My prediction is, and we'll see. I've been predicting this for 2 years. We'll see. But my prediction is that tomorrow, the next day, as the fight is fought and the vote is taken for the leadership of the House of Representatives, that Eric Cantor is going to challenge John Boehner. And once again, fracture the Republican Party, because John Boehner has come to now represent the Republican Party of at least some moderate reasonableness, whereas Cantor is representing the Republican Party of, you know, the crazies and the bought off by the billionaires. So we'll see. So on the one hand, it looks like a big victory for the president. On the other hand, there was no stimulus in this bill. It's preventing a disaster to the economy, but it's not helping the economy. He didn't get an end to the sequestration. He did, to the debt ceiling. So basically that and sequestration are coming up down the road. And as I mentioned, we will talk about as we go on through the day here, there's a lot of really creepy stuff in this bill. Like, you know, hey, you want to subsidize NASCAR? Or how about the oil companies? A lot of money for them, too. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Who won? Who lost? Why? How? What does it matter for you and me after this? And Django. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, bottom line. I knew that there was more to Django being just a movie because for several days between Christmas and New Year's, on Drudge's website every day, they were trashing Django Unchained, this movie. And Drudge is like you know, famous for portraying black politicians, particularly President Obama, in ways that emphasize their race in a negative context. But this was something else. He wasn't going after actor Jamie Foxx, who's African-American, or filmmaker Tarantino, who's white, but who made the movie. This was more subtle. What Drudge was doing on the Drudge Report, on his right-wing so-called news website, was he was suggesting that Django was a failure as a movie. In other words, a financial failure, that people weren't showing up to see it. And obviously, the reason he's doing that, he's trying to discourage people from seeing the movie. So I'm sitting here looking at this going, why? Why is Drudge trying to discourage people from being a movie? I mean, you know, what could it be? I mean, here's a movie about a black hero. Is that what's causing the hard right to go nuts? I mean, I saw the movie on Christmas Day with my wife Louise and our kids, I think two of our three kids in Portland, Oregon. The audience was all white. They cheered the black guy and his wife. But is that enough to draw the hatred of the hard right in America to get you on Drudge Report trashed? I mean, plenty of movies have African-American heroes. Do really well with white audiences, and they don't get trashed by hard right so-called news websites. And so for like, you know, 3 days, I'm walking around going, there's got to be something I'm missing. You know, why? What's Drudge so upset about here? And then it hit me. The importance of that movie, Django Unchained, the importance of that movie is not just the horrors of slavery, although that's really important about it, and it's not that it's a really great story of a knight off to rescue his damsel in distress, which it is, and it's not about brilliant acting on the part of Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio, and it's not about brilliant filmmaking. Instead, it was a giant middle finger to the South. And not just to the South of 1858, which is when the movie is set. It was a screw you to the South of today. And all the Republican politicians from other parts of the nation, increasingly, including the Midwestern states, where the KKK is on the rise since the Obama election 4 years ago, who have adopted the divisive, or is that divisive, however you say it, and race-baiting politics of the South. From Michigan Governor Rick Snyder handing over entire largely African-American communities and schools, school districts, to crony emergency managers to loot on behalf of their rich buddies, to the Republican governors pushing voter suppression ID laws, to the raw racist rhetoric by national Republican legislators that they're going to break President Obama, to the white politician who shouted, "You lie," during a State of the Nation speech, to these Republicans who proudly brag and repeat that their first and most important job was to make sure our first African-American president is a one-term president. You know, these guys, they don't use the N-word as publicly or as frequently as their political ancestors did back in 1858 or as is used in the movie. Instead, they use phrases like states' rights. You know, where Ronald Reagan gave his first speech in 1980 after he was nominated for president of the United States? He went to a little town of fewer than 10,000 people down in Mississippi, Philadelphia, Mississippi, and he gave a speech on states' rights. And there were all these white folks around America who just kind of didn't notice that because they didn't know what was going on. And what, Philadelphia, Mississippi? Did he get the state wrong? Did he mean to go to Pennsylvania? Oh, no. This was Reagan's first speech as a Republican running for president of the United States in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were murdered. Or Republicans talking among themselves privately, where they say things like, there are people who will vote for the president no matter what, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they're victims. There are people who pay no income tax, and so my job is not to worry about those people. Remember when Mitt Romney said that? They're following the strategy that Richard Nixon pioneered for the Republican Party. He called it, proudly, his Southern strategy. So here, now just consider this. In this movie, there are two primary white characters. One is played brilliantly and brutally by Leonardo DiCaprio. He's got a thick Southern drawl and the worldview of those people who are today working to suppress the black vote. The other white character in the movie speaks with an accent that's somewhere between John Kerry and Martin Bashir, and he's horribly offended by that Southern ethos. Guess which one of those two white guys is the center of evil for the movie? Now, you know, again, there's a lot of black primary characters in mainstream movies that draw large white audiences. And Jamie Foxx is as brilliant an actor and as strong a character as you'll ever see in any movie, regardless of race or genre. But when you see Django Unchained, you'll understand why Foxx is not just playing another black action hero or action hero generically. This movie is about something altogether different. It's about a culture in the South that existed for hundreds of years before 1858 and is still alive today. Quentin Tarantino and Jamie Foxx have delivered a clear message to the Tenthers, the Birthers, the Secessionists, and the voting ID suppressionists of today's Republican Party, and their very few high-profile African-American enablers. Now, I don't know if that was Tarantino's goal. I mean, you'd have to ask him, and I don't know him. I haven't asked him. But speaking for myself, to this white movie viewer, that subtext to the movie was inescapable. And what caused me to suddenly realize it, I got to say, apparently, it was also inescapable to Matt Drudge. Because, like I said, you don't see right-wing news sites going after movies. And just a full disclosure, by the way, I'm not plugging this because Leo DiCaprio's in it. I am in one of his movies. It's called The 11th Hour. It was inspired by my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he and Robert De Niro are going to star in a movie that's going to be out this year by Warner Brothers that's based on a book that Lamar Waldron and I wrote called Legacy of Secrecy. But I have not discussed this movie with him, and this, you know, I'm not here to pitch the movie. I'm here to say I thought it was amazing, and there's something going on. I think that there's people are waking up to that Southern worldview.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Let me rephrase that. White people are waking up to that Southern worldview. African Americans have known about it long. We'll be back. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour to the place where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman Program. We will, as we continue through the next 2.5 hours of the program, I'm going to get into a lot of the details of what happened with regard to taxes and all this stuff. But yeah, it's some of it's kind of dry. Some of it's very interesting. One of the most interesting parts is Daryl Issa voting to last year made $15 million. And the capital gains rate at midnight, December 31st, went up to, and most of his $15 million was capital gains, that rate went up to 39.6%. And this piece of legislation dropped it down to 20%. But he still voted no. So did he vote for or against himself? That's an interesting one. We'll get to that. But I want to get some Django comments in here first. Sharon in Alexandria, Virginia. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio, Sharon. What's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I hope you're well.
Yes, I am.
So you wanted to comment on the movie Django Unchained.
Yeah, did you have a question or you just want me to just talk?
Just go off on it. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I actually loved it. And, you know, I love Westerns. I have always loved classic Westerns. I love spaghetti Westerns. And I thought Tarantino did a great job doing a Western. And I thought that I thought it was powerful. And I thought that by making a Western about a slave and then the hero being a slave, because in the Western, the hero is always good. And Jamie did a really good job playing the hero in a Western. And so he did kind of thumb his nose at the South and said, screw you, South, which is what a hero in a Western always does. Whoever his adversary is, the hero is always good and his cause is always just.
Right.
And it's always kind of, most of the time it's a revenge movie. You know, the hero gets screwed over in some kind of way and he goes to get revenge. You know, Open Range or Pale Rider or, you know, some of the best Westerns are revenge Westerns.
All those ones that Clint Eastwood made.
Yeah, well, Open Range, I think that was Kevin Costner.
Yep.
And I love that, you know, and then even the guy who was at the house, I think he was from one of the old spaghetti Westerns, you know, the guy who said, how do you spell that?
Mm-hmm.
His face was so familiar. Like,
yeah.
Tarantino went back to one of the old movies and pulled up one of the, Yeah. So, some of the old ones, also were revenge movies. Some of them were like robber capers or whatever, but a lot of the great ones were revenge movies, you know? And, so it's not like he invented this genre. He just, you could tell he loved the genre itself. And I think for him to set it in slavery, he was trying to make a point. And he did, I think, make a great point, you know, by saying it was ugly. And it was a brutal time in our history, and we need to deal with it. But it was humorous. I thought a lot of it was funny. And, he liked the part with the clothes where the girl said, and you chose to dress like that, you know, the audience kind of, you know, cracked up. Yeah. When, cause he had that blue kind of, I don't know what that getup was, but
yeah.
You know, when Jamie, yeah. When
yeah.
He chose
kind of frilly blue thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it was funny. It was, you know, some parts were, you know, hard to watch, like when they were doing the main dingo fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really hard to watch. And, you know, the more excited the Leonardo DiCaprio character got, the other people in the room couldn't watch it, you know.
Yep.
Did
you, Sharon, did you see the audience? Did you see the movie with a largely African-American audience? Or
Yes, I did.
What was the response like in the theater? Was it?
It depends on what parts. Like, you know, a lot of people found, like, there was a lot of laughter in the movie. I think they found a lot of humor in the movie. I think Tarantino, it was almost like pseudo-comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people laughed in the show that I was at. There was a lot of laughter in the movie theater.
There was, with the white audience that as I was watching it too, I think what Tarantino does is he builds up the pressure and then there's a moment of comedy that lets you kind of release it with that laugh, you know, and then the pressure starts building again. Brilliant filmmaking.
The black audience that you saw in the bathroom, they were very somber. I was surprised because when the audience walked out that I was with, it was very upbeat.
Oh, okay.
Jovial and, you know, it was giggling and it was very upbeat.
Okay.
You know,
well,
with the prancing horse at the end and, you know, he was showing off for her. It was very cathartic, I thought. I don't know. The audience I was with was not like that at all.
There was like 20, 30 people there. I mean, you know, it was going in and out of the men's room and whatnot as we were heading out. So, I mean, there was admittedly a very small sample.
Because it was very upbeat and happy, and it was nothing like somber or anything like that. It was smiling, and you know, that when we left, it was a long line of people coming in to see the movie. So,
yeah.
You know, and it was a mixed audience coming in.
Yeah.
We saw our earlier show. I'm sorry.
My other big take on this, Sharon, was that I think the sense that I got from overhearing conversations amongst the white audience as they were leaving the theater, over and over and over again, I was hearing variations on, my God, I never realized. I mean, it's like white people who have grown up their entire lives with no contact whatsoever with black people or black culture, which is like, you know, Portland, Oregon, or a lot of, you know, communities in America. I don't think that they ever had that visceral sense or experience or understanding of what slavery was like or pieces of slavery. You know, they have an intellectual understanding of it. And this movie gives people a visceral understanding of it. And I'm guessing for African Americans it was no surprise.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, we haven't experienced it either. But I don't know why the oral tradition hasn't been passed down to Caucasian. You know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's because
we're embarrassed by it. We're horrified by it. We're ashamed of it.
Wow. Because, you know, it's like, you know, we understand as African Americans that horrible things happen. You know, and I don't know what's missing in the education system orally from I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what I'm trying to say. I mean, it's not like we have experienced branding or whipping or anything like in my generation, but we know it took place, and we know that rapes took place, and we know that beatings and child molestations and anything that has occurred in this world today, we knew took place to our ancestors. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and so the shock that those things were visited upon our ancestors, and that white people don't know that. We're like, how can they not?
I can tell you, there's a lot of white people who just, you know, never really, I mean, you know, they, like I said, intellectually understand it, but it never got real for them. It was never personal. I remember when I was about, I don't know, 10, 12 years old, my mom was doing this whole genealogy thing because her side of the family came over, like, you know, before the American Revolution, blah, blah, you know, and they lived up in Boston, Massachusetts. And she discovered this one ancestor who had moved to Tennessee who apparently owned a slave. And she told us about it. I mean, she was going through this discovery process, and she was like, oh, my God. She was, like, horrified by this. And then she tracked back this guy, and she got these records and found that every month, like religiously, at the first of every month, he would buy a slave. And she thought, my God, he was a slave dealer or something. And then she discovered that what he was doing was he was buying them and helping transport them up north and freeing them. And that was like for our family, like some kind of repentance is the wrong word, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, thank God we were on the good side of history, kind of.
Right,
thing,
you're on the good side. Your side of the angels.
Yeah.
Your side,
yeah.
Side of the angels.
But it was like that was as close as it ever got to being real, I think, in my own, you know, just growing up, you know, in my family and experience. But you know, I've heard stories from African American friends about, you know, that have been passed down in their families about what happened to literally their great grandparents. I mean, you know, within the memory of their parents, you know, stories being told from people from that period of time, from the 1850s. And so.
Well, I mean, it's just not that difficult from just anything that you see people own.
Yeah.
If you own something and you've seen the cruelty of how people treat something they own,
yeah,
it shouldn't be that difficult to make that leap.
Yeah.
If you see how people treat dogs that they own, or dolls that they own, or, I mean, you know, you just don't have to be black to understand how vicious people are with anything that they own.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen people who own a car, and they treat their car like a piece of crap. And if you say you own that person, and you say, if I think I own that person, and I see how people act when they think they own something, what's the worst that I think that person can do if they think they own that person? You know, and you look at, I don't know, you look at your neighbor, and your neighbor's like,
oh, you got to bleep. I'm sorry, Sharon, I got to drop that. I got to drop your call because we just can't say that word on the air. We just dropped it off the air. My apologies. We will take a break. It's 44 minutes past the hour. We will be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. 45 minutes past the hour. My apologies to any of our listeners. Sharon's inadvertent word got through and you were offended, my apologies. We'll be right back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. 866-97-THOM. You can drop by our website at tomhartman.com, post blogs, message boards, things like that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Django Unchained, Fiscal Cliff. Who won, who lost? What is this going to mean for 2014? I got some serious thoughts on that, too. Stick around.
The smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about anything.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. I'm here with you, Frank, in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Yes, I was listening to your conversation, and I think that this is really scratch a sore. But the point I'm trying, what the point I have to make is that it's not, this issue right now about black and white is not all black and white. I have been, I'm a white person, I'm a white man, 67 years old, I've been married to a black woman for the past 25, 30 years.
Wow. You've been married since it was illegal.
Yeah. And probably in Massachusetts, yeah. But I have experienced racism. We try to check into a hotel in Laconia, New Hampshire, and the guy said, we have no more rooms, and so we left. And the guy behind us, his wife, he started to leave. He said, oh, no, you stay. They were both white.
Mm.
And we had to drive all the way back from Laconia to Cambridge.
Wow.
Because we no rooms at the inn, as you know.
Yeah.
Now, I have been, as a white person, I am, you know, led into this racist talk. For years I've been, you know, and in my early years, I felt victim to that and started assuming the same sort of prejudices,
mm-hmm.
you know. Then I went to school in the South, and it was so atrocious. I mean, people driving, college students driving in cars in black neighborhoods, whacking black kids with sticks mm-hmm. and driving off. This is in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think it's changed, in 2001, they murdered a guy they suspected to be, they thought it was a Muslim, a Sikh. They thought was a Muslim
yeah.
in a parking lot at the University of Kentucky.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's changed. And that's my whole point, is that Quentin Tarantino
yeah.
and Leo DiCaprio and Jamie Foxx made a movie that basically told that culture of the South. And as I said, it's not just the South. I mean, this is what Rick Scott is, or Rick... Scott Walker. No, I mix up my Ricks and my Scotts. The guy who's the governor of the state of Michigan. Rick Snyder. Thank you very much. What Rick Snyder is doing in Michigan, turning, you know, African-American communities over to, you know, white emergency managers and selling all like that park in Benton Harbor that had been given to the city forever in the name of this family back in the 19-teens in the name of her daughter who died. And it was in an African American neighborhood, and a white golf course wanted it. And so, guess what? They sold it.
Well, that's exactly the point that I'm trying to make, is that when I was in college, I went out with a white girl who was upper middle class, all white community, and what there was no mention of black. There was just it wasn't an issue because I wondered why there was no, they didn't talk about that.
Yeah.
Because the reason why is that there were no blacks in their environment. There were no blacks in their community, in their circle of friends.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that there is a kind of collective consciousness of the history of slavery, of which whites are deeply and profoundly embarrassed and ashamed and horrified. And therefore, it's difficult for white people to talk about. And therefore, it just doesn't get much talked about by white people. Frank, I got to move along. I got a bunch of other callers here. Let me get somebody else. And thank you for your call and for your sharing your stories. Tony in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Tony.
How you doing, sir?
Very well.
I went to see the movie as well on Christmas Day, and it was a mixed audience.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm in the South. So I was sitting beside this white guy, and I heard his comment to his friend was like, this movie is making white people look really bad. And I'm not saying that's the point of the movie. No, I don't know what the point really is, because I'm not Quentin Tarantino and know what his point was.
Yeah.
I thought it was an excellent movie because I think a lot of people, black and white, especially the younger generation, they just think slavery was, we worked for whites for free, and when we didn't do what we were told, we got whipped and whatnot. So it wasn't all that bad. But that movie, even though it was fictional, it showed, because I read a lot of, black history books and, the narrative of Frederick Douglass and whatnot, and it talked about the horrors of slavery, the mistreatment of another human being. And to see that, I mean, I didn't even really see that in Roots, the movie, because I'm old enough to know when that came out. Yeah, you saw a little bit of that in Roots.
Yeah.
But this movie, to me, it showed more of the treatment. Yeah, it had some, laughter and comedy in it, but... the Mandingo fighting, when they put the dogs on the guy and whatnot, it really showed what we as black people know of the horror of slavery and why to this day some blacks in some parts of the country, whether north or south, are still horrified and kind of afraid of a lot of whites. They kind of dumbed down to them or whatnot.
And I would think
passed down.
And I would think why when a white politician says he's going to break President Obama, you get that visceral response of, you said what?
Yeah, those cold words that they use, and it's just, I don't know what this country I don't want you to wear old to, you know, blacks or, you know, African American. I don't know. I think if anything with, you know, education, you can't get money, but because it was 300 years of uneducated, you know, ownership of another human being.
Yeah.
And so the discussion of it, and I'm glad this movie came out because it opens up discussion, and it shouldn't be something, it's America. America is a great country. I'm very patriotic to this country. I served 8 years in the United States Air Force. You know, I love this country, but it has a bad history that needs to be talked about, and I don't know what that's going to do for this country. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of whites are afraid that we're going to get angry and start some kind of riot. You know, those are the ignorant ones. That could happen on a small scale, but I think as a black man, we just wanted to be acknowledged of the treatment and tell the truth of what happened with this country and why America benefited from it.
But there was a black Holocaust. There was an African American Holocaust in the United States, and before that, and during that, in fact, I mean Abraham Lincoln. There was a Native American Holocaust. Abraham Lincoln continued to murder Native Americans at the same time that he was emancipating African Americans, in theory. So, but excellent point, Tony. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Fiscal Cliff, Daryl Issa, Hillary Clinton, Frankenfoods, Django Unchained. We're going to get back to all those things, but Dr. Art Kaplan is with us. Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor at New York University's Langone Medical Center. His website, pophealth.med.nyu.edu. And, of course, there's a link to that off tomhartman.com. And Twitter, at Arthur Kaplan, C-A-P-L-A-N. Dr. Kaplan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and thanks for joining us. I was intrigued by this piece that you published that frankenfish, this genetically modified salmon, is less of something for us to be afraid of than a McRib sandwich from McDonald's, because the McRib sandwich is, you know, full of sodium and fats and awful things, and with which I totally agree. But I was surprised that you would say that something that has been modified in a way that our species did not evolve to interact with would be a good thing. I don't get that.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the reason I got angry enough to write a column about this was that the fish and the McRib appeared in the same week. McDonald's brought the McRib back last week. There are about 46 million people that eat at McDonald's once a day. I know a lot of people want to get worked up about the genetically engineered salmon, which is the fish that the FDA approved last week. But really, if you look at food safety, if you look at the impact of what we're eating on American health, you got a lot more to do at the drive-through than you do with a genetically altered fish that's supposed to grow faster.
But isn't that a little bit like saying, well, you know, the guy next door is, you know, beating his wife, but, you know, they're killing people over in Syria right now, so I guess I'll ignore that.
No, I actually think the fish has some value. Growing it faster, making it cheaper, would put more fish in our mouths. I'm not worried about the safety of eating genetically modified fish. It's the genetic change that's done to make it grow a little faster, pretty trivial, involves...
It's altering the levels of growth hormone.
Well, it does, but they're there naturally, and you're taking growth hormone genes from a related salmon, a Chinook, and putting it into this Atlantic salmon.
So why not breed them the way that, you know, Gregor Mendel back in the 15th century, if I recall correctly, you know, showed us, not how to do, but, you know, chronicled with peas, if I remember. I mean, it's been a long time since, it's been 30 years, 40 years since I took that biology class. But
it's true, we do have this image of Gregor the monk out in the garden sort of slowly crossbreeding his plants with bees. But, you know, the way the food industry for about the past 50 years has been making new plants and to some extent animals is radiating their genes. They put these things in front of radiation, look for mutations, and voila comes the tangerine, voila comes different breeds of apple. So it's not like we're using the old, let's wait seven generations in
well,
the garden.
Well, and that's my point. I mean, we're looking at explosions of things that we don't understand. There's, you know, there's an explosion right now in autism. There's an explosion in obesity. Mm-hmm. There's an explosion in you know, a whole series of different physical, psychological disorders that nobody is able to clearly understand or explain. And yet at the same time, we're saying, well, you know, we think, you know, it's just fine if the big corporations that want to make money by feeding us do so by genetically modifying our foods.
Let me jump in on one thing. I think we do understand one of those ones you mentioned, and that's obesity. And what's happening is we're getting swamped with sugar and fructose. We're all at the fast food lines. The diet stinks. If you can make fish cheaper and put it on more plates, even with the genetic modification, which I said doesn't freak me out too much. I think it's a minor tweak. I guess I'm there.
But again, I think you're, you know, that's the false equivalence of the guy next door beating his wife, but, you know, they're killing people in Syria. It still is the question of do you really want an industry that is modifying things like this, you know, this genetically modifying things? Mm-hmm. You know, the story of Klebsiella? Planicola.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this just to recap real very quickly, Klebsiella planicola was it's a bacteria that exists in the roots of virtually every plant on Earth, and this company genetically modified it to convert cellulose into ethanol, thinking that, you know, hey, we'll solve the problem of the leftover wheat after wheat is harvested, and, you know, all this extra cellulose, and we'll be able to produce ethanol for the world. And it almost got into the wild, and if it wasn't for this one, you know, PhD student up in Oregon, as I recall, discovering that this stuff killed every plant that it attached itself to by alcohol poisoning, it could have ended all plant life on Earth, which would mean that we'd be dead. And this was just 20 years ago.
Right. Well, let me jump in. I'll give you the how I'll get out of the beating my wife leads to it isn't that bad because of Syria kind of analogy.
Thank you.
I think genetically modified food can be green, can be nutritious. What's happened is big corporations have used it to make it compatible with their herbicides and their pesticides. That's what Monsanto did over the years. It's right. The wrong way to go. The reason I like this GM fish is I think it's safe genetic engineering. It's good for nutrition. It's good in terms of being burdensome on the environment to grow the fish. So you're right. We do have to watch about where.
So can I? May I make an analogy that is sort of like your one that I knocked down, and you're free to knock this one down. But you know, when we developed the bomb in the 40s, the Department of Energy was created in large part because you had a whole bunch of scientists, and I don't know if you ever read the biography of Teller, but. You know, who felt just insanely guilty about having created a weapon that killed a million people or half a million people, whatever it was, in these two cities in Japan. And they thought they could redeem themselves with nuclear power. And now, you know, we've got nuclear power that, you know, look at what's happened in Fukushima. I mean, it's a pox upon the planet. Should we, aren't there some technologies? And in my mind, nuclear energy, certainly just nuclear period is one of them. And in my mind, genetically engineering things in ways that don't comport with normal evolutionary processes, even Stephen Jay Gould types of evolutionary processes, driven evolution, that don't comport with that. Aren't those technologies that we should simply say, that's a box that we're not going to open, Miss Pandora?
I'm going to say no. Because I think we can control the GM technology, take the world and its 9 billion people, feed them, use it, as long as we hold it accountable to, you've got to make me more nutritious food, you've got to make me food that puts less burden on the environment.
But doesn't your example of McDonald's prove that that's not possible? I mean, McDonald's is
big companies trying to use it to, you know, continue to advance their old agriculture built on pollution that's destroying the land. This thing gives us a way out. I think we should think about.
But doesn't McDonald's prove the opposite? I mean, you said, you know, okay, we're going to, you know, we want people to behave in a responsible fashion, and yet they're literally cutting down the rainforests to grow beef for, I don't know if it's specifically for McDonald's, but for the fast food industry in the United States, and it's destroying the lungs of our planet. And that's not even GMO. You're expecting these big GMO companies to behave ethically when just a fast food chain can't?
Well, I'm going to say, to get your approval, let's set the standards. Show me that it's green. Show me that it's nutritious. Show me that it's going to lessen the burden on the environment. Then you get approved. You just show me you're going to destroy more jungle, or you're going to pour more pesticide on your soybeans. What do I need with that? That's just profiteering.
Well, I get it. I just respectfully, I think you're speaking like the proponents, the well-intentioned proponents of nuclear power were in the 50s and 60s.
Well, nuclear power, I think, you know, in its way, not so well understood.
Yeah.
Engineering a fish gene, better understood. I'm not worried about it running amok. What I think we can do, though, is feed the planet. And that's probably our biggest moral duty as we look at where we're going now.
Yeah, or maybe look at the fact that we can best reduce population by empowering women around. I don't know. We could go all kinds of places with this. Dr. Arthur Kaplan, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
It's a pleasure.
Great talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. GMO fish? California, hey, you can't even know that something's GMO. Django, the fiscal cliff. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. It's a real problem. You know? Anyhow, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what you were just talking about. I think the problem is that, you know, we should use the most appropriate technology, the simplest technology to get a result, and that is to increase our food supply. But, you know, you can't rule out these very complex technologies, and you're not going to get very objective information out of our land-grant colleges and universities who are so linked to, you know, moneyed interests.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm not really in favor of eating genetically modified fish. I'm not in favor of eating genetically modified grains. There's good evidence now with genetically modified grains that they do interact, and not in a good way. They
right.
cause the gut to absorb food, and there's an increase in food allergies. And there's also an increase in inflammation, which is causing other diseases. So, and that comes from the Rodale Institute. But you will not get a lot of objective information, plus also outside of this country where they have, you know, they don't allow GMO.
They basically ban these things. No, I'm totally with you, John, and excellent point. There's not a lot of objective research supporting them. There is some really scary research coming out about genetically modified products, and that's why I you know, respectfully disagree with Dr. Kaplan. I think that this is the nuclear power thing all over again. We are messing with the forces of nature, and really, if we're concerned about feeding humans and or starvation on Earth, we should be reducing the human population. We're pushing 9 billion people. There were only, you know, 1 billion people on Earth in the year 1800. There were only 2 billion people on Earth in 1930. It's like, you know, we need to dial it back. And the way to dial it back, frankly, is by empowering and educating women, because that's the one thing that will always cause population to stabilize. So anyhow, John, thank you for the call. An excellent point. Elizabeth in Brookville, Ohio, you wanted to talk about Django Unchained.
Yes. Tom, I want to say that the movie was very wonderfully portrayed. And I want you to know that I live those conditions. I lived through much of that.
Seriously? How so?
Today, the Southern and Midwestern thrust to bring about states' rights and small government is another way of bringing back many of those old practices that were used to suppress African Americans. My great-grandfather was the first free man in his family. He was able to accomplish a lot, especially after the government gave federal courts authority to eradicate many of those old Southern practices.
Mm-hmm.
Today,
so, I'm sorry.
And the movie, by the way, I think the better part of the movie was not spoken. It was just left for you to conceptualize, and which means that it was a lot deeper than what is moving conversation now.
Mm-hmm.
Under states' rights now, and many people don't understand this, it gives the majority population, ethnic group, power to set standards for other people's lives, especially ethnic minorities. And that involves employment, because with the federal government not involved, then they can hire whom they want, and they could not hire whom they want.
Yep.
To hire, which is generally minorities, and force you into substandard jobs. By the way, my father and all of his brothers were veterans, you know, of World War II. Mm-hmm. But when they returned to the South, they had to work in creosote plants and in fields. And I mean cotton fields where airplanes were spraying out pesticides, and all of them died of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the way, with the way the Republicans are saying reduce this relieve us of some of these standards.
Yeah, these regulations.
Well, if there are no environmental standards, then people are going to get sick.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent point. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story with us. It's very, very nice to hear from you. Thank you. Wow, remarkable. Sam in Adams Run, South Carolina. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Thank you for your information in terms of educating us. I'm a relocator from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to go see this movie, I'm here in the rural South where it was hard for me to conceptualize what this culture was all about. And after seeing the movie, it hit me that this is like post-traumatic stress, because my experience of the movie was profound, and I couldn't really place exactly what the anger, what the fear, you know, what that emotional piece was that I was experiencing. And it's like, it's still going on today.
Yeah, that was my point. That Southern culture, slavery might be gone, but the culture is still there. And the oppression of African Americans and other minorities is still very real.
Right. And the things that I experienced and in my community in terms of even addressing it, or recognizing that there is this emotional piece, just like me being a Vietnam vet, that experience and the stories from my parents of their experiences have an emotional impact on me. But what I do about it, to instead of suppressing it, to acknowledge it, and that it's so blatantly put in front of the political screen with the Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Sam. We're out of time. I thank you for the call, I totally agree, and that's why I said I think that this movie. Hang on just a second here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Guy always steps on me. That's why I think that this movie was a giant, you know, screw you to the South. And Tarantino, he was saying, you know, no more of this. So we're going to break the president's stuff. Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. And we went off on this last week at some length. And I think I wanted to revisit it today because the time is drawing short. I think personally that if the Democrats are going to take back the House of Representatives in 2014, it will be because Democrats in the Senate are able to demonstrate over the next 2 years that they can pass good progressive legislation that benefits the people, even if it dies in the House. and then people will have a clear choice. But they won't be able to do that if the filibuster is not reformed. And the guy who is leading that charge, and this, I think, is one of the most important issues right now, and it's going to go away really soon, is Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon. Senator Merkley, welcome back to the program.
Oh, Tom, it's great to be with you, and you're absolutely right. If we're just paralyzed, then why would you have a reason to go one way or the other, if you will, and you don't see a vision of where the Democrats would take folks?
Yeah, I really see this as the, you know, the 2014 election, both in the House and the Senate, is going to hinge on whether you guys can successfully reform the filibuster. So, and the filibuster, for people who might have just tuned in and don't know what we're talking about, is the ability of a small number, in some cases one, Republicans, or certainly a minority, fewer than 50% of the Republicans, to block legislation arbitrarily. I mean, just they don't even have to give a reason. They can just say, nope, not going to have it. And a lot of good legislation has died in the Senate because of this filibuster rule, and you want to change it so people have to, well, you tell us.
Well, at one point, the filibuster was an issue of deep personal principle, but now it's become an instrument of partisan politics. So the entire minority caucus says we will back up the filibuster, that is, not give votes to close debate, and then you're just stranded, you're just paralyzed. And we see this time and time and time again. All of the time that the Senate should be working on the issues, the big issues facing America, is spent being paralyzed, and it so frustrates Americans. It's no wonder that we're in such low esteem.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so one key piece of this is to say, listen, if 41 vote for additional debate, then you have to actually have additional debate. You can't vote for it and then just sit back and wait for the majority to put together a supermajority. You have to make your case before the American people, before your colleagues. The American people and your colleagues can weigh in on whether your argument is good or bad, whether you're a hero or you're a bum. And it's the belief, certainly my argument, is that you have to spend time and energy to filibuster. You won't filibuster trivial things, hopefully. Now, that's the hope. And second, the American people can judge and weigh in and help their senators decide whether they should support it or oppose it. And I think on so many issues, the DREAM Act, the Disclose Act, the president's jobs package, the pay equity, I think we would get 60 votes to shut down debate if the public could see what was going on.
Yeah, these were all pieces of legislation that were killed by Republican filibusters in the Senate that should have passed, that should be law right now. And you want to modify that. You and Tom Udall and Elizabeth Warren, if I have that right, and a group presumably of other senators, but you're kind of the,
right.
The tip of the spear.
There's probably a dozen folks who have contributed really a lot of time and effort to this effort.
So, and then I understood that Senator Carl Levin from Michigan has been working with John McCain on a more watered-down version. I'm not going to ask you to trash your colleague, but how... You know, do you have any sense of how this is going to play out, and, you know, which of these two, your vision or Senator McCain's vision, what's going to happen, and when does it happen?
Well, first let me tell you, Senator Levin is a huge champion. His Subcommittee on Investigations does enormously tremendous work. He was my key partner on the Volcker firewall, trying to separate lending banks from hedge funds, which is so important to America.
Yeah, he's a good man.
But on this issue, we disagree. He believes that just by more rigorously enforcing the existing rules, we can force the Senate to move forward more quickly. However, the proposal he's put together doesn't address a secret filibuster. It doesn't require folks to actually put their hand out there in public and say, yes, I'm obstructing. There's been 41. I'm going to make my case on the floor. And in addition, it gives the minority a big gift, which is additional guaranteed amendments, something that they don't have right now. So if you don't take away their key tool and you give them additional gifts that can be used as poison pills in the process, then I think it just reinforces the paralysis we have right now.
Right. So which way is Senate Leader Harry Reid going, or do you know? Or I mean, I went to his website and sent him an email. I called his office and left a message just as a citizen. You know, I think that he represents all of us in America as the Senate Majority Leader. And I'm encouraging my listeners to do the same. Any sense of where this is going, and what should people who are listening to this conversation right now do to support your efforts to reform the filibuster?
So Leader Reid is wrestling with putting together a package. He's pursuing two courses. negotiations with the Republicans, looking for the possibility of a 67-vote pathway or a 60-vote pathway, which I'll explain in a second. And he's also looking at a package that he feels is right, that he will rally 51 senators around, and that would be without any Republican support. So he's exploring both. Because of the Hurricane Sandy and the fiscal cliff, the caucus really hasn't processed these issues. The body of the Senate hasn't. And so what I expect him to do is to keep the session to recess tomorrow on the first legislative day, to recess rather than adjourn, and basically say we're going to pursue this rules debate when we come back on about the 22nd. If he does that, we have a couple weeks to really have the conversation that we need to have.
So resolve. In other words, I mean, the Constitution basically says that the Senate and the House, but in this case the Senate, sets its own rules on the first day of its new session. I thought the first day of the new session was tomorrow, was Thursday.
Yes, so the Constitution just says each House can set its own rules.
Oh, it doesn't say the first day.
But it doesn't say first day. So the first day has gained resonance because of the logic that you set the rules before you start the game.
Right.
Like, you know, a game of softball, you don't change the rules in the third inning. You do it at the front end. And in addition, there's kind of a Senate tradition of having these arguments, these discussions of rules at the beginning. So for those reasons, that's why the first day is deeply anchored. We call it the constitutional option, not because the Constitution says the first day, but because the Constitution says you do have the power to organize yourselves. And that's something traditionally that happens at the beginning. But what people can do now is they need to weigh in with their home state senators and say this paralysis is unacceptable, and having the paralysis be silent and hidden so that all the public sees is a quorum call is unacceptable. That if people are going to argue that they need more time to debate, they have to debate, and so the public can then weigh in. So call up your senators, ask for the talking filibuster, that is critical to have in this package, and to have an overall a robust reform of the filibuster.
Yeah, I referred to it in my emails as the Merkley filibuster, but talking filibuster sounds just as good. Is there a website for this or anything like that?
Fixthefilibuster.com.
Thank you.
It's a way to directly weigh in.
And filibuster is spelled with one L, right?
That's correct.
Okay, fixthefilibuster.com. All right. Further you'd like to add to this at this point?
Well, the package should include eliminating the filibuster on the motion to proceed,
right,
because that's a debate over whether to get to a bill,
right,
not a debate on a bill. So it doesn't enhance debate to object to holding a vote.
Right. So and this is what you're proposing.
Yes, and we should get rid of the filibuster on going to conference committee, because that's after you've passed the bill and you just want to start negotiations. There shouldn't be a hurdle in place to start negotiations with the House. It used to be everything went to conference committee. You worked out your differences. You brought them back. Now we've had only half a dozen in the 4 years I've been here. It's just too hard to get to them. There's three filibusterable motions and a huge invitation for the continued paralysis, politics of paralysis that the Mitch McConnell's been practicing.
Yeah, I was in a meeting with Harry Reid a couple of months ago, and he made the comment that Lyndon Johnson had been Senate Majority Leader for the same number of years as he, as of probably this point in time right now, 6 years, and that Harry Reid has had to deal with almost 400, 370 or something like that.
It's over 390 now.
Over 390 Republican filibusters. And Lyndon Johnson, in those same 6 years, when he had the same job, dealt with one Republican filibuster.
One, that's right.
It's just incredible. Just incredible. So fixthefilibuster.com, Senator Jeff Merkley, and call your senator's office. And if you have a local office in your state, also call that, you know, whatever it may be. We need to get this thing done, and we really do need to fix the filibuster. This sounds wonky. You know, a lot of people, you go filibuster, they go, what are you talking about? Their eyes glaze over. They don't know what it, but this could be the key. Literally, it could be the key to the 2014 election.
You know, so many folks, when they hear filibuster, they picture folks standing on the floor. They
Jimmy Stewart.
Inherently understand that's what you should have to do. You should have to spend time and energy to block a majority vote. Let's make it so.
Yeah, absolutely. If a senator believes strongly enough that a piece of legislation is bad, that even though the majority of the Senate wants it, they want to stop that legislation, let them stand up and make an eloquent case for that and try to change the minds of their peers.
Yes.
But right now, basically, they can just say, in secret, they can say, stop it, and then they can go to dinner, right?
Yeah, they simply object to a simple majority vote, and then there's no requirement. There never has been a requirement to speak.
Yeah.
But the reason they spoke in the past is because they believe if they obstructed the Senate, they had a responsibility to make their case.
Right. Well, responsibility and modern-day Republicans don't go in the same sentence. I know you're too much of a gentleman to say that, but I will. In any case, Senator Jeff Merkley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I much appreciate it. Fixthefilibuster.com. Be sure and check it out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with the Talk Radio News Service and your calls as we continue into the next hour of the program. Stick around. Let's check in with the news here. Our news brought to you, Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can help free slaves in Sudan and receive a photo of the goat that is given to the slaves. It's a whole concept. Check it out at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You'll see what we're talking about. Founded by Alan Ratner, the founder of the Talk Radio News Service. With whom is Victoria Jones? Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So I got your email newsletter this morning. It was one of the best summaries I've seen of everything that happened with regard to this whole fiscal cliff stuff. So, but what's on your list of important?
Well,
news?
It's not my lead today because I figured there's been so much fiscal cliff stuff and there's so much else going on.
Okay, so what are you on?
Hurricane Sandy relief.
Oh, yes, Peter King was, first he's angry, now he's not.
But Chris Christie was angry. Wow. New Jersey governor held the presser of all pressers. That press conference, if you get a chance to watch those highlights and get some popcorn. Unbelievable. He had a Howard Beale moment. They're so caught up in this politics of this fake fiscal cliff and this palace intrigue.
Yeah.
I'm not dealing with the Tea Party. Next!
Right.
Unbelievable.
It really was. If you want to take 30 seconds, I can play a clip of it for you.
Please.
Okay, here we go. Clip 3.
There's only one group to blame for the continued suffering of these innocent victims. The House majority and their speaker, John Boehner. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. National disasters happen in red states and blue states, in states with Democratic governors and Republican governors. We respond to innocent victims of natural disasters, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as Americans. Or at least we did until last night.
And then he gets even more heated, but I don't want to take up more of your time.
No, it's fascinating. That was before he went off.
Yeah, before he totally lost it. Okay.
Totally lost it. So anyway, so after that, interestingly, and after the speaker huddled with House Republicans, he has scheduled a vote on Friday on $9 billion of flood insurance relief for Sandy victims and another vote before January the 15th on $51 billion of Sandy relief.
Now,
of course, will be in the 113th Congress.
Right. And which will have maybe a new leader. Who knows? And my theory on this is you've known for the last couple of years, I've been talking about how Eric Cantor, you never see his right hand when you see him standing right behind John Boehner. And it's because he's holding a shiv right up to Boehner's kidney. And, you know, there's some speculation that Cantor may challenge Boehner for the speakership. But now Peter King, who is all upset about this, has come out and said publicly just in the last hour or so that he will vote for John Boehner for speaker. In other words, this actually is starting to get personal, do you think?
It is possibly starting to get personal. Now, there is a rumor going around that Republican leadership are meeting later on this afternoon and evening to talk about leadership, or that Republicans are meeting to talk about leadership. Now, whether any decisions will be made at that meeting, if it takes place, I don't know. But I've heard from a couple of sources that that is going on, and I know no more than that.
Do you think that there's a serious possibility that Eric Cantor is going to challenge John Boehner?
What I've heard more likely is that Boehner might be just saying, I've had it.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think he'd say that, though, if he didn't have a challenge.
No, I don't think he would either. I think he's a fighter. But whether Eric Cantor would, I don't, it's just so extraordinary.
The thing that really made me think that was going to happen was when Cantor and McCarthy, the number two and number three Republicans in the House, voted no on this fiscal cliff legislation that Boehner voted yes on.
And then Paul Ryan voted yes, severely damaging his chances in 2016, some would say, as a presidential candidate when Marco Rubio in the Senate voted no.
Yeah, although 2016 is a long time from now. 2014 isn't that long from now.
No.
So anyway, who knows?
No.
So what else is going on?
Well, an interesting little story. You'll remember that less than 2 weeks ago, a newspaper published the names and addresses of handgun permit holders in Westchester and Rockland counties, New York.
Yes.
Well, now officials in neighboring Putnam County say they will block the release of their own permit data requested by the paper.
So the paper's trying to expand their publication.
Yes.
Oh, very interesting.
The county clerk and other officials are meeting today to discuss legal options for stopping the release of the permit information, saying they have over 11,000 pistol permit holders, and I refuse to put their lives and their families' lives in danger. When these laws were conceived, there was no social media. There was no Google Maps. Nevertheless, interestingly enough, a state Republican who represents the area says that they will not be releasing the names to the Journal News, and saying the paper unethically reveals homeowners with pistol permits. However, the State Committee to Open Government said the officials would be breaking the law if they refused to release the records, because the name and address of any handgun permit holder shall be a public record. And he read a section of New York State law to the New York Times.
Hmm. So who's going to break? Who's going to give up? How's this going to play out? Or is it going to go to court?
It looks like they're going to fight it. I mean, it's unclear whether the county officials have any authority to block the release. The newspaper is using the state's freedom of information law. I think the newspaper is going to fight this as far as they can.
And this is New York State, where the NRA can't quickly get the legislature to convene and change the law.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
Very interesting indeed.
Okay. Got about 15 seconds, I think.
Filibuster reform is in serious trouble in the Senate.
Oh, no. We were just talking to Jeff Merkley.
Well, it's because he's likely to vote against McCain and Levin,
right.
Who've got the watered down version,
right.
And it's unclear how far his is going to go. If you've talked to Jeff Murphy, then you know more about the story than I can tell you in 15 seconds.
Well, he was not willing to say where everything was at, but he was saying everybody needs to call their senators, and I'm totally there. You know, I think that the 2014 election is going to be decided by whether or not this filibuster gets fixed. So we'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just to recap what happened over the last couple of days. I think it's quite important that we actually pay attention to what's going on here and understand. There are people who are running around going, oh, yeah, the Democrats won. And there are people who are running around going, oh, yeah, the Republicans won. And it's not either of them. It's the billionaires who won. The capital gains tax. Now, here's just kind of a simple setup for this thing. There's two ways you can earn income in the United States. They used to be called earned or unearned income. Now, they don't use the word unearned so much anymore because it sounds kind of Frank Luntz wouldn't like that. So it's called capital gains or dividends or interest, carried interest. But basically, the two ways that you can take money and put it in your personal checking account out of a business is you can write yourself, or you can have the business, assuming it's not your own business, the business can write you a paycheck, which is how most people take their pay, and virtually all small businesses do. You will hear Republicans say, oh, well, you know, you're going to, you know, if you do away with capital gains, you're going to raise taxes on small businesses. Sorry, I own a small business. I can tell you, I called up my CPA, you know, several years ago and said, hey, this capital gains thing is kind of cool. I own a bunch of stock in my own company. Can I declare a dividend? And he was like, no, you can't do that. That's considered tax evasion. So small businesses can't do that. You know, I have to take a paycheck out of my own company, and it's taxed at, it's going to be taxed, it would have been, well, it's now going to be taxed at 39.6% or whatever it is. You know, this the old Clinton tax rate. Actually, it won't be taxed at that much. It'll be taxed because I don't make more than $450,000, but it would if I did. So that's the top tax rate for earned income. For unearned income. Now, this is how Mitt Romney makes a living. It's how Paris Hilton makes a living. It's how George W. Bush was making a living when he was born with his trust fund. Basically, people who have what's called passive income. In other words, they're living off their investments. Now, I'm not talking about grandpa who's living off his pension or who's living off a little bit of, you know, a couple thousand bucks a year he's getting from the stock that he bought back when he was a youngin'. Because, you know, yes, that's capital gains, but he's making so little. Because the tax is a progressive tax, so he's not paying capital gains tax of any consequence. But for the people who are making $1 million a year or hundreds of thousands, over $450,000 actually, or $10 million a year, or in the case of a dozen guys on Wall Street, over $1 billion a year, if you make money by the sweat of your brow, if you're a surgeon or a rocket scientist or a researcher or, you know, fill in the blanks, anything, you pay up to 39.6% income tax. But if you make your money with money, like Mitt Romney did, like Paris Hilton does, you know, with her inheritance, like the Walton heirs do with their inheritance, if you make your money with money, used to be that you paid a maximum 15% income tax. It was called the capital gains rate. By used to be, I mean up until the end of last year, 2 days ago. And then at the end of the year, midnight, December 31st, that capital gains rate went from 15% all the way up to 39.6%. So all of a sudden, the Koch brothers' income and the Waltonaires' income and, you know, all of the income that they're getting went from a 15% tax rate to an almost 40% tax rate. Bang, just like that. Now, if they were taking it as paychecks, it will still be taxed at that rate if it's over $450,000 a year for a family, $400,000 for an individual. But most people at that income level don't take it as paychecks. First of all, a company can only deduct the first $1 million in salaries that they pay to any individual. So most companies don't write paychecks for more than $1 million because it's not tax deductible to the business. So how then, you ask, can CEOs like Stephen Jay Hemsley of United Healthcare make $1 billion? $1,000 million. How can he do that in less than a decade? Well, you know, you pay them in stock. And then when they sell the stock, it's called capital gains. They pay a maximum 15% income tax, which jumped up to 39.6% at the end of the year. And then came along this legislation, which dropped it back down to 20%. And if it's less than $450,000, it's 15%. So guess who won? The real winners were the billionaires. Now, nobody's much talking about that except, you know, there's a few blogs that you can read that are like blogs for billionaires, you know, where the investors blogs. And, oh, you know, whew, missed the bullet on that one. So on the one hand, you've got people who are supportive of Democrats and the president politically and, you know, in memosphere saying, well, it was a great victory. It was the first major tax increase in 20 years. And arguably they're right if the vote had been held before the end of the year. But it wasn't. In fact, even the Senate waited until after midnight for the vote. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's when the House votes that it becomes law. So, but because they waited until after the first of the year, which is exactly what I've been predicting for, what, 6 months now on this program, almost every day? Everybody goes, oh, the fiscal cliff, all right. I'm like, don't worry. They'll take care of it the day after, you know, January 1st. They'll take care of it. And guess what? They did. Because the day after the end of the year, the Bush tax cuts expired. They were passed by reconciliation. In other words, they couldn't be filibustered. But legislation passed by reconciliation can only last for 10 years. Obama extended them for 2 years when the Republicans held hostage the nation and actually the nation's unemployed people, unemployment insurance. And so that 12 years, that ran out. So the tax rates went up. Capital gains rate, the rate for millionaires, multimillionaires, and billionaires went up to 39.6%. And so in rides the House and the Senate, and they cut that back down to 20%. So you could say this is the biggest tax break in history, or not in history, but, you know, one of the biggest in modern histories. And that's true, too. I'm inclined to say that the winner here is the president and the Democrats because of the optics of it. This is perceived as a tax cut. As a tax increase. This is perceived by the American people as raising taxes on rich people. When in fact what happened was that the top tax rates on rich people, the Bush tax cuts expired, taxes went up, and Congress then came in and said, okay, we're going to keep those top tax rates on people who earn over $450,000 a year, but on unearned income over $450,000 a year, we're going to drop it from 39.6% down to 20%. So Mitt Romney's tax rate actually went up slightly as a result of this. It was 15% last year. It's 20% this year. Paris Hilton's tax rate. But it's still nothing close to what, you know, surgeons make, or pay, rather, excuse me. So, you get this? But the Republicans are trying to pretend like they got had by the president because they want to play the victim. The Democrats, and, you know, to their base, oh, we need, you get more of the out voting for Republicans so we can, you know, whatever. And then you got the Democrats who are trying to claim a victory. And I think, you know, we should just clearly look at what it is.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Politically, it's a Democratic victory. Economically, in reality, it's a victory for the billionaires.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed. Welcome back. Place where despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman Program. And Mark in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, Mark. Thanks for listening to KBBR. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that I appreciate you having Senator Merkley on. I'm very proud to have him as my senator out here in Oregon. I have a couple of comments for you, one about the fiscal cliff and one about Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
First off, the fiscal cliff deal, I don't think we can really tell who is the winner in this because I see this sort of as a three-act drama, and I'm reminded of what Chekhov used to say about you never bring a handgun onto the stage in the first act unless you're willing to use it in the third act.
Mm.
And the handgun in this scenario is the debt ceiling negotiations.
Yep.
And we'll see. You know, President Obama says he's not going to fire that handgun, and Republicans in the House and Senate have both said that they are willing to fire that handgun. And, you know, we really won't know how this all turns out until we see how this whole thing plays out.
Well, that particular issue is going to be a real measure of how courageous is not quite the right word, but I lack the word this president is, because there are a lot of constitutional scholars, and I've said, you know, I ranted about this last week on this program. I think he's probably one of them who know that the 14th Amendment explicitly says that the full faith and credit of the United States shall not be questioned. In other words, you can't say the government can't pay its bills. And it's unconstitutional to say so. The law that created the debt ceiling is unconstitutional. And so what the president can say when Congress says, no, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling, he can say, fine, you guys, you know, you can not raise anything you want, but I'm going to direct the Secretary of Treasury to keep paying our bills. And, you know, end of discussion. I'll see you in court.
Right. And we'll know a lot at that point, because a lot of the sequestration is going to happen at the same time. And, we'll find out a lot more about what happened yesterday.
Yep.
And then with Django Unchained, I like the movie. I tend to like Tarantino films. I like the Inglourious Basterds film about the Nazis and the Jews in World War II. I felt like this film was based on vengeance, and that vengeance for an injustice perpetrated and against people, especially that are maybe helpless or, you know, without sufficient power to fight back. That's a common theme in a lot of his films. And I think people kind of like vengeance. There's a certain strain in American culture that likes the vigilante kind of justice. But I find that disturbing, because I think it undermines true justice that we can find through developing a democracy and a legal system that works.
Well, I think, you know, vengeance is a two-edged sword, and we saw that. And excellent point, Mark. Thank you for calling and making it. We saw that in the Bush administration when basically, you know, we were hit by 9/11, and George Bush's response was to lash out, and there should have been a legal response. There, you know, we should have, if we were going to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, we should have gotten authorization from the United Nations. We should have put forward some evidence. When Afghanistan offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and turn him over to a third country for trial for 9/11. And George Bush said, no, we'd rather bomb your country. I mean, that's vengeance gone wrong. That, you know, and what's the biblical saying? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. In other words, it's not ours. But justice, it's also appealing to I think a primal instinct in humans. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. And I'm pretty ambivalent about it. Tim in Lincoln Park, Michigan. Hey, Tim. Genetically modified organisms.
I wanted to get back to that real quick. One thing the scientists have discovered over the decades in studying the genome is it's not a static architecture. You know, we know that the genome codes for proteins which build up our cells, and also, of course, the genome, you know, is pretty much DNA exists in almost all organisms except for a few viruses, I think. So the point is that the DNA itself does not stand still. It actually moves. Scientists have discovered things called jumping genes and so on.
Yeah.
And also anything that could enter the DNA may alter the DNA itself in ways that it's almost like if you went into a library and you tried to move the books in the library, the books would keep moving. You know what I mean? So when we play around with these GM foods, we don't know what on earth, what kind of proteins may code for which types of perhaps diseases, or which type of how these organisms will interact even with the environment.
Right. This is my argument to Dr. Kaplan, which is we're the product of a billion years of evolution.
Yeah, we evolve. Yeah.
And all the things we eat are the product of a billion years of evolution. And you know, they may not be the best things for us, but at least we have developed defenses and resistances and associations and symbiosis and all those, you know, and to just take something and radically change it like this, to take a gene from one animal and put it in another animal, or to take a gene from an animal and put it in a plant, or vice versa, I think you're absolutely right. It's a Pandora's box that just like with nuclear power, I don't think that we should have opened. Tim, thank you very much for the call. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, got a minute to the break. It's yours. What's up?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, on the deal on this so-called fiscal cliff, the legislative deal on this, while I agree with you that economically the billionaires were the winners, politically I do think that the Republicans won in the sense that, first of all, they were allowed to vote on this this whole deal in a way where they were given the advantage because they were allowed to vote. They avoided voting on any tax increases because
they were not forced to vote before the end of the year. They were allowed to vote after the first of the year.
Exactly, which was a tremendous advantage for them. And yet in exchange, there's no evidence that they made any Medicare-related or Social Security-related concessions in the sense of taking that off the table, taking Medicare and Social Security off the table with respect to either major changes or cuts.
No, they will be back to try and cut those things, and it's going to happen at the sequestration time and at the debt ceiling time. At the end of February, early March, it's going to be a very, very, very interesting time. And we will find out whether President Obama has, and the Democrats, in putting this thing together the way they did, or Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell, whether they sowed the wind and will reap the whirlwind, or pick your other lousy cliche, or whether they're playing three-dimensional chess. We'll find out. Jerry, thank you for the call. 27 minutes past here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Do you know that U.S. Internet users pay more for slower service than pretty much anywhere in the world? What can we do about it? I have an idea. The good, the bad, and the very, very batrachoidously ugly, the good. Congressman Adam Smith. Smith was on Fox and Friends this morning and schooled the trio of talking heads on the specifics of the fiscal cliff deal and President Obama's role in the debate. Check it out.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you can say, well, he's not showing leadership, but now what you're saying is he showed leadership, but nobody else was willing to.
Right.
So it's really hard to blame the president.
Sure,
Let me also make the point.
Okay.
Speaker Boehner, the Republicans, what have they put on the table in terms of specific spending?
Oh, absolutely. Look at the Ryan plan.
Well, the plan was not specific spending
cuts.
No, a budget is not an appropriations bill, Brian. The budget said, across the board, we will cut 10%. We're not going to tell you what, we're not going to tell you where, we're just going to imagine that it's going to happen. In terms of specific spending cuts, the president had actually put more on the table during this last negotiation than the so-called fiscal conservatives leading the House.
Really? Because I don't know anything that he wanted to cut. Besides defense.
I just told you.
Yeah. It's always refreshing to see some semblance of accurate information coming out of GOP TV. Good on you, Congressman Smith. The bad. The American Family Association, the conservative Christian organization, emailed its members today with a warning that by the year 2060, Christians will be treated the way African Americans were during the Jim Crow era. The email also warned that states would take charge of children beginning at birth, and that due to the separation of church and state, towns with religious-sounding names would be forced to change their names. Basically, the AFA believes that there's a massive conspiracy underway to wage war on Christianity and to attack the freedom of religion. Kind of sounds similar to the AFA's war on homosexuality, doesn't it? And the very, very ugly, Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman. Grothman is waging war on Kwanzaa. In a press release, Grothman argues that Kwanzaa is a fake holiday that was invented for the purpose of dividing and destroying America. In a press release, Grothman writes that the founders of Kwanzaa, quote, don't like America and seek to destroy it by pretending that its values as expressed in the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution don't apply to everyone, end quote. In reality, Kwanzaa was established in 1966 to celebrate ideals like unity, collective responsibility, and self-determination, and to celebrate African-American heritage and culture. Grothman's misguided attempt to discredit Kwanzaa is the latest development in the war on religious freedom, the real war on religious freedom, that is taking place in America today, and it is very, very ugly. It's an interesting kind of double backflip there. Internet services, I mentioned as we went into the break, internet services in the United States are incredibly expensive, and it blows my mind. I spend, with AT&T, for my phone, it's like an extra $40 a month to get the data service. If you want to use your phone when I travel, I don't want to just latch into anybody who's Wi-Fi, and there's all kinds of problems of viruses and things. You want to use your phone as a hotspot for your own computer. It's like $40 a month. And then the service like is just it crawls. And in you know, most European countries, you can pick from dozens or hundreds of internet providers, of cell phone providers. And what's the result of that? The price is really low. New York Times did a piece on this about 2 years ago. And in fact, I went off on it at some length on this program at the time about how in France, for about $40 a month, you get high-speed internet service, which is 10 times faster than ours. You get telephone service, and you get cable TV. Why? Because different companies can compete, because the monopoly of owning the copper is not allowed there. The copper wires or the fiber optics, whatever it may be, is considered part of the commons. We used to live in Vermont, and there was this company called Sovernet in Montpelier, Vermont, that competed with Verizon or whatever. I think it was Verizon, but whatever the local phone company was. And you know, their service, it was $25 a month, flat rate. If you called for help, I mean, or the, you know, for telephone service. And if you called for like service or repair, the guy came from three blocks away and knocked on your door. You know, I mean, literally you're talking to one of your neighbors. And in fact, he came over a lot because we started this radio show out of our living room in our house in Vermont. We ended up having to have six phone lines installed, and it was all through Sovernet. And so what did the big phone company do? They tried to introduce legislation repeatedly in the Vermont legislature, and I'm guessing probably by now it's passed, saying that whoever owns the copper can decide who you know gets to use it. In other words, putting these small phone companies out of business. And it's the same thing that they've done with, you know, they're locking up broadband service, and it's like we're paying absurdly for it in this country. So anyway, just an editorial note. There's a piece in Bloomberg about this. U.S. internet users pay more for slower service, that kind of restates the obvious, and I'll just leave it at that. Rod in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hey, Rod, what's on your mind?
Hey, man, I just want to let you know that I have a White House petition on their site. It's not public yet because I need at least 150 signatures to get it public to ask the president to assert the 14th Amendment in the debt limit crisis.
Hey, good on you.
I posted the links on your blog today in the comment section of your blog, the long link and the short link.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to get a few more. I think I got like seven signatures or more. I need at least 150 to make the thing public.
Right.
And I want to get more than 25,000. I want to get a response from the president why he can't assert the 14th Amendment.
Cool. How do people find this? Where do they go?
Well, like I said, I posted the two URLs, one's a long one and one's a short one, on your today.
Oh, okay. So if you go to TomHartman.com and you look at my blog on the front page, you posted as a comment to my blog the URLs for your petition over at the White House website.
Yeah, once we hit 150, they'll be able to search for it. But right now, they won't publish it until at least 150 people sign up for it and
cool.
Spread the word. I think this is something we all should be pushing.
Yeah, I agree. Rod, you just spread the word. And thank you for starting that petition. That's a great suggestion. And once again, if people want to find it, go to TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And on the homepage is my daily blog. And if you click into that, you will see where people can respond to it with comments. And one of those, Rod, what's the username or what should they look
Brenda
for?
Brenda Green, and it was on today's blog.
Okay, say that again.
I posted it as Grundy Green to your blog that you posted today, January 2nd.
Okay, great. Rod, thank you very much, and good on you for doing that. That's marvelous. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael.
Tom, let me take this minute to tell you that answer to your question, my thoughts on it about the Internet, the United States being made into a third world nation is what it is.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that they're taking away our power as an influence in the world. So that if people will be scrambling for the resources, food, and et cetera, and then we'll be subject to their rule to maintain an illusion of sovereignty or an American Constitution type of sovereignty.
I would submit to you, Michael, that we are already at least 75% of the way there. That we got put on that track really, really fast with the NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. We are now subject to transnational corporations making decisions that trump our own laws in the United States. And the only thing that's going to change this, and then the Supreme Court, you know, 2 years ago saying corporations are people and money is speech. The only thing that's going to change this is if we amend the Constitution. If you go to movetoamend.org, and start a local group to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people, money is not speech. I don't know if you saw the news story, but Hobby Hub or whatever it's called, what is it, Lolly Hobby, yeah. Hobby Hooby, Hobby Lobby. Thank you. I knew there was an L in there somewhere. Hobby Lobby is this company, this craft company that's owned by a super fundamentalist Christian family, and they don't want the women who work for them to be able to get contraceptives. We're just talking birth control pills here. To be able to get or condoms for that matter. They don't want them to be able to get contraception paid for by their health insurance plan. And that's a requirement of Obamacare. And they were shot down by the Supreme Court, and they are fighting this, and they're willing to take a fine on this. And now it looks like they found a federal court. In fact, it was ruled on just a couple of days ago. A federal court said, oh, wait a minute. If the U.S. Supreme Court if the U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United said that corporations are persons and have First Amendment rights of free speech, then they must also have First Amendment rights of religious liberty. And therefore, Hobby Lobby has a First Amendment religious right to refuse birth control or contraception to women who work for them with regard to their health insurance plan. And
I think that we are all just headed toward this world where people become third parties to other individuals' beliefs. You know, we are free, or liberty, as far as the America is concerned, is the same liberty that is being sought throughout the world. These congressional representatives that we have in our Congress, many of them, are subject to corporate laws and corporate legislation.
Sure. Well, look at all the guys who signed Grover Norquist's pledge. I mean, when you swear your oath of office, you have to swear that you've made no prior commitments to anybody that will impinge on your behavior. And yet these guys, these Republicans, they all signed a pledge saying, I will never raise taxes. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. And that's the smallest piece of it. I mean, the largest piece of it is now, you know, big corporations and billionaires can politically destroy somebody or politically build somebody with unlimited resources, and you'll never even know who they are if they choose to hide behind, you know, the Citizens United. We've got to change that. Michael, thank you for the call. We've got to change that. Get over to movetoamend.org and sign up. 15 minutes before you go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, that's movetoamend.org, as in amend the Constitution, because the Supreme Court has screwed this thing up so badly. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Tom Hartman Program. No, it's not a person. Come on, I know these wackadoodles on the Supreme Court. But Nick in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Hey, Nick, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to, I've been on for a while, gather my wits here. Mm. The Fiscal Cliff situation, I'm extremely disappointed, disgusted is more like it, with Obama's performance. I think that what happened is that he had the Republicans basically by the cojones, and not only failed to squeeze hard enough, but really didn't squeeze at all. I think what we've got here is a situation where for 4 years, the president has consistently gotten the short end of the stick in these kinds of confrontations. And we had hopes that, you know, once we reelected him, maybe he would find his courage. I don't think he's stupid or incompetent. He clearly understands all the ins and outs and all the negotiating tactics, and the extent to which he's dealing with recalcitrant, I would call them political economic terrorists at this point. I mean, when will we ever get a better negotiating point than the Republican Party holding hostage 98% of the American people to give a tax break to 2%, and then we bump it up to 1% by making it up to 450, as if the middle class was between 250 and 450 per year.
Right.
It's insane what happened yesterday, and for 3 hours now, I've been listening to you talk about it in a very rational, cool, calm, and collected way, which you want to do, but if people understand,
it's too late to do anything about it. But you're absolutely right in all the details of what you said, and in fact, I can make it even worse. I mean, you know, the goodies that were given away are just, you know, incredible. I've got a list of them around here someplace. Ah, here we go. The GOP Clown Act. Ah, here, 8 huge corporate handouts in the fiscal cliff bill over at Aldernet. Helping out NASCAR, $100 million or so for the railroads. Disney's got to eat. Help a brother mining company out. Subsidies for Goldman Sachs. You know what? Goldman Sachs is going to get $1.6 billion in free tax-free financing for the new massive headquarters in New York City as part of this legislation. I mean, you know, but you're absolutely right. The president, this was his point of maximum power over the Republicans. And thank you, Nick, for calling and making the point. This was his absolute point of maximum power. And he used about half of that, in my opinion. Now, the other side of that argument, and the argument that I am quite certain the White House would make, is that had he gone the whole way, had he said, okay, you know, we are going to bring you guys to your knees, that people like me would be cheering him on, people like you, Nick, would be cheering him on, but, you know, the millions of people whose unemployment insurance would stop would not be cheering him on, the GIs, veterans benefits that would stop would not be cheering him on. That in the process of holding this nation hostage, the economic terrorists, the Republicans, would actually cause enough pain that eventually the president would have to blink. Or actually, frankly, I don't even think that that's what would happen. They would eventually cause enough pain that the middle-of-the-road Democrats in the Senate would have blinked. And that is the situation that we're at. The president largely has to deal with the hand that he's got. And yes, it was a point of maximum advantage. And yes, he still has people like Max Baucus in the Senate. And he's still got some folks in the House who, you know, sometimes they'll go with the Republicans, sometimes they'll go with the Democrats. And, you know, it would have been nice to see the Republican Party self-destruct. And it looks kind of like maybe that's what's happening. I haven't quite totally, I was going to say I haven't quite figured this out. I mean, I understand all the dimensions of what's going on here. And I can lay out for you all the details of it. And in fact, I've been doing so slowly over the last 3 hours. All that said, the people on the far right, and I'm going to be debating this tonight with a couple of conservatives on our TV show on The Big Picture. The people on the far right they're feeling like they got screwed, right? There were no spending cuts. And the people on the far left, what we used to call the center of America, people who think we should have strong Social Security and, you know, rich people should pay, you know, reasonable taxes and maybe having more billionaires isn't a good idea. And people in favor of card check and unionization and whatnot. Those of us on the left feel like, oh, you know, we didn't get the best deal. But right down the middle, for the average American, I think that there's a very high probability, and here's the reason why I'm saying this, I can't say it with certainty, is because we'll never know. I mean, you know, what happened is what happened, and everything else is theoretical. But I think there's a very high probability that this is going to work out well for the president and for the country, even though the price that was paid was things like, you know, giving Goldman Sachs goodies and making sure that Mitt Romney's taxes never go above 20%. So we'll see how it plays out. Richard in Bourne, Texas. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Bernie, Texas. How are you
Bernie,
doing, Tom?
Texas. My apologies. I'm well. What's up?
No, everybody mispronounces. What I'm talking about is the people that we've had in there. We just got reruns. We got reruns from 20, 30 years. How long have these senators been in there? It was never designed that these people stay in there for life.
Well, actually, it was.
They go up there, they serve, go home.
Well, you know, no, actually, at the founding of this country, there were a number of people who were professional politicians. You know, Thomas Jefferson was one of them. You know, arguably Ben Franklin was one of them. James
Madison.
They
had jobs.
Nah, not so much.
They had jobs other than that. But Obama, with this thing, he proposed 250,000. Okay.
Right.
These people are looking up. I've served in two wars. These people are looking out for themselves is what they're doing. They're not looking out for this country.
They're looking out for their wealthy patrons. Because their congressional pay is around $170,000 a year. Daryl Issa, notwithstanding, making $15 million last year. But yeah, the billionaires are calling the tune right now in America. That's why, and Richard, thank you for the call. That's why we need to amend the Constitution to say billionaires can't buy elections anymore and they can't buy politicians anymore. Coming up tomorrow on our program, we'll have the latest on how the fiscal cliff deal will affect you and find out what's next. Now that the 112th Congress is vanishing today, what can we expect from their successors in the next session? Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science Rocks, and the best of the rest of news and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It's not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it. Get involved. Get out there. Get active. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.